Tour. Auf die Rechte.
Der deutsche Spargelkult müsse enden.
Germany's beleaguered defense minister has temporarily dropped his PhD title.
Volkswagen ist eine Perle der deutschen Industrie. Und ich glaube, das kann man
nicht sagen. Ich weiß, wie viel Liebe dahinter steckt. Wenn Glühweinstände aufgebaut werden, wenn Waffen...
Spargel-Weltmeister ist China, denn die bauen 60 Mal mehr...
Hey, this is Ted. Welcome to Spaßbremse. We've got another great interview for you today, this time with Gray Anderson, an editor and historian based in New York. He edited the book Natopolitanism, which is out this year with Verso. It's a collection of chapters from top experts on the NATO alliance. I've heard from a few people recently that they were surprised with our recent interview with Günther Fellinger, and kind of giving a platform to his views on foreign policy and the alliance. So you can see this episode as kind of a counter to that one, with the current one you're listening to expressing views that hew a little closer to those of our podcast. Gray and I get into all the history and details of NATO, so I won't give much away here. But just a quick update as far as Sweden's membership goes, because we mentioned that. Looks like Turkey, which had been blocking it, is now set to debate the issue in parliament soon. President Erdogan, after having agreed to it, has asked the parliament for a speedy approval, but they have said that they're in no hurry. Still, that looks to be all but a foregone conclusion. So the accession of both Finland and Sweden, which had long been neutral, and their desire to join NATO was, of course, prompted by the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. Their accession now looks to be all but complete, just some time before Sweden finally gets in there. And before we cut to the interview, I just wanted to say thanks so much to all our supporters and listeners, especially our patrons on Patreon. If you support us there, you get access to all our premium episodes, including an excellent recent live recording on plagiarized PhDs in German politics, which had been a long-promised episode and really kind of the core of Spaßbremse lore about Germany. So not one you want to miss. Go on over to patreon.com/Spaßbremse, Spaßbremse, to access that. And of course, if you can't subscribe now, we totally understand, but please do share the podcast and rate it to introduce us to new listeners. And with that, on to the interview with Gray Anderson. Hey everyone, welcome to Spaßbremse. This is Ted, and I'm joined here by Gray Anderson, a historian and editor based in New York currently. And he is the editor of a recent volume that just came out with Verso Books called Natopolitanism, the Atlantic Alliance Since the End of the Cold War. And I've been wanting to do this interview for a while now. It's a really fascinating volume. A bunch of really impressive scholars assembled here in the piece, and of course with never-ending political geopolitical tensions, questions about the role of the U.S. in the world. Of course, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is always at the center of those questions. And actually having a critical take on the history of the alliance and actually what its purpose is, I think is a really valuable contribution. And so I'm very excited to have Gray here with us today to discuss. So thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And to start out, I think, you know, we'll get into all the details, of course, because Gray also has some excellent piece. There was an opinion piece in the New York Times when this came out, and also a piece in the New Left Review that outlines some similar arguments here. And for people that don't observe NATO too critically, you'll often just hear kind of every time there's a summit, all the leaders get together, they say, maybe make a few plans, maybe issue some statements and so on and so forth. But you'll hear this phrase over and over when they pat each other on the back. They say, NATO is the most successful military alliance in the history of the world. They're, of course, referring to the fact that, you know, NATO was the counterpart to the Warsaw Pact during the Cold War, and I guess NATO's still there, the Warsaw Pact's not, and so therefore it's the most successful alliance in the history of the world. But you raise a really important question. I think it's kind of the main core of a lot of this. is you take aim at that word successful, basically. I think you probably would argue that it is successful, but successful at what? And you often argue that it was successful at something, but not the thing it claims to be successful at, which is just, you know, the sort of nice defense of all these Western democracies. So if not pure defensive protection of our nice Western liberal democracies, what actually was and is the purpose and role of NATO politically?
Well, that's exactly right. And it should be said, perhaps, that NATO is not alone in this respect. There's a more general tendency diagnosed 50 years ago by the great diplomatic historian Paul Schroeder to assume that military alliances are essentially about maximizing the power and therefore the security of their member states. This is what he calls capability aggregation. And Schroeder, in a study of alliances essentially since the end of the Napoleonic Wars up until the Second World War, proposes that, in fact, this type of capability aggregation is not the only and perhaps not even the preeminent function of such alliances. But in fact, they have all sorts of other things they do, in particular in peacetime. So these include spreading ideology, perhaps facilitating commerce, and also controlling alliance members. There are means whereby weaker states potentially can attempt to rein in stronger states, and conversely, stronger states can manage, to some degree, interfere in the affairs of weaker states. So that's the framework, really, with which I approached NATO. And there's quite clearly a contrast, as you indicated, between what the alliance in its official statements and semi-official literature pretends to be, says it is, and the historical record. So if we look at the first category, that is to say, what NATO pretends to be, we can identify kind of three primary functions. The first, of course, is collective defense, right? Aggregating, again, the capabilities of its member states. The second is an alliance of democracies, that is to say, not only an alliance of democracies, but an alliance which spreads democracy and a kind of assortment of other values associated with democracy, including notably civilian control over the armed forces. Thirdly, and more nebulously perhaps, NATO has often been perceived as an expression of a kind of collective identity, what for a time was referred to, and I think Walter Lippmann's phrase, as an expression of the Atlantic community, which we could think of as a predecessor perhaps to today's so-called international community or simply the West. Now, if one then turns to the sort of balance sheet of the alliance, and here perhaps it's best to start with the Cold War period, because it's important, no doubt, to emphasize that the balance of these functions has not remained perfectly stable over time. I think we can kind of identify three other and to some extent different functions in the minds of the alliance's architects and in its actual practice. So the first would be counter-subversion, right? The first would be control against the threat of disaggregation, a crisis of morale, defection on the home front in Western Europe. So the notion that faced with the threat of a prospective invasion by the Red Army, citizens and perhaps politicians in Europe would simply, in a sense, surrender before a shot had been fired. The second function...
That being especially important, of course, in the early Cold War era. I mean, NATO being founded in 1949, now it doesn't seem like such a, you know, an immediate threat with the sort of decline of communist parties in Europe. But, you know, in the late 40s, early 50s, there was strong organic support for communism in Western Europe, just to sort of place that fear that NATO policymakers would have had in context. Right.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, it should be said, of course, I mean, including at the heart of the alliance in Italy and France, you have communist parties which command, you know, up to a third of the share of the vote and so on. I'm not trying to agree with you that this function hasn't, in a sense, perdured. I mean, if you look, for example, at the counter-disinformation campaigns that are being waged quite aggressively by both official NATO bodies and some of these kind of semi-private or para-official bodies, but we can perhaps get into that a bit later. But during the Cold War, in any case, I mean, the second function that has to be stressed is that really of containing in a sense, Germany, containing German power and integrating West Germany, the German Federal Republic, into a wider U.S.-led system of international order, geopolitical, economic order. There's a quote by a CIA officer from the very beginning of NATO, who says essentially the point is not settlement of the German question, that is to say, reunification, some sort of accord with the Soviets, but rather the long-term control of German power. So Germany, of course, is perceived both for reasons of its economic and potentially military strength, also its geographical position, as the key to this whole European security architecture. And then thirdly, there's a more expansive goal of managing Western Europe and ensuring in general terms that no other power, that is to say, no power other than the United States, managed to establish hegemony over this crucial Rhine-Ruhr region, seen again by U.S. American geopolitical thinkers from really the beginning of the 40s as the linchpin of essentially Eurasian power. So those, I think, and we can maybe get into the details a bit further, are really the three goals NATO set itself from its inception. And, you know, to come back to the point you made in your question, I think, you know, a strong case can be made that it was indeed extremely successful in carrying out all three.
And I think that's I like that, you know, that list is a great way to kind of frame these roles. And like you said, they're all present, but shifting in importance over time. And so I think we can keep those in mind as we kind of run through a little bit more of the history from that starting point in 1949. And you mentioned already the entrance of, you know, West Germany, the Federal Republic, into NATO in 1955. Again, to try to, you know, place ourselves in the mindset of what people at the time would have been feeling about this. I mean, you can understand the anxiety this would provoke both in Eastern Europe and in France. I mean, this is just 10 years after Germany was defeated, obviously trying to wage genocidal wars of conquest in Europe. And so the idea that we're giving these people, you know, their guns back and they're actually joining the alliance, it seems so like such a foregone conclusion now, but in retrospect, you know, this would have been a pretty shocking thing to do. And you quote, like you said, this the CIA analysis, and this is from your New Left Review piece. You said, with the entry of West Germany, it settled the question of who's going to control the German potential and thus hold the balance of power in Europe. Not for the last time, the alliance effectively resolved a problem of its own making. Having opted for remilitarization, the Americans found themselves obliged to garrison hundreds of thousands of troops in West Germany, as much to reassure its neighbors as to deter the Soviets. This is another theme that comes over and over through the history, is solving a problem of its own making. So could you talk a little bit about that decision and then how NATO then can repeatedly justify its own existence by having created a crisis, which then it is the only solution that can solve the crisis that it either in whole or in part actually prompted in the first place?
Absolutely. So maybe the first thing to say is that it would be a mistake, of course, to see the advent of NATO purely as an American imposition on hapless or cowed Western Europeans. Indeed, the project for the alliance itself, as I suppose is well known, emerged from a kind of Franco-British scheme in the very immediate post-Second World War period to keep alive their wartime alliance, spearheaded by, among others, Ernest Bevin, a ferociously anti-communist foreign secretary in Clement Attlee's Labour government in the UK. And so this takes form by 48 in an alliance between the UK, France, and the Benelux countries, so-called Brussels Treaty. And then talks almost immediately begin to draw the US and Canada in. But the reason I say this now is that other European powers also had an interest in ensuring that the U.S. commitment to European security be maintained even after the end of hostilities with the Axis powers. And one reason for this, among others, is, of course, the concern of Germany's neighbors that it might, after two world wars, once again pose a threat to peace on the continent. So this is a desire which you could also say is present too in West Germany. West German leadership in this extraordinary, quite harrowing period of reconstruction is very conscious of the fact that if Germany has a road back to sovereignty, perhaps, to continental world power, it is going to have to reassure, right, the other European states. And so a minute ago, I mentioned the objective of containing Germany, or what the German political scientist von Hahnrieder described as dual containment, that is a containment both of the Soviets, hopefully, and of the Germans in Europe. There's also a form of self-containment, if you like, that West Germany ends up exercising via NATO and the Americans. But to come back to your question, you're of course precisely right that the question of German sovereignty, of German rearmament, the idea that a German army, you know, might once more be formed and you would have German soldiers in uniform in Europe only a decade, right, after the defeat of Nazism, is extremely controversial at the time. And in terms of the alternative, right, when I say that NATO, in a sense, solved a problem of its own creation, the alternative was, of course, a neutral Germany, a neutral, unified Germany, which was the option proposed notably by the Soviet Union. This is rejected by the Americans vehemently.
Austrian model, in a way. I mean, we spoke about this in our last episode, but this is sort of what Austria got, right? Like, there are two things on the table. Austria stayed whole, but neutral. Germany could decided to not be neutral, so it could not be whole.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And clearly, in a sense, it was a kind of, it's a question really of realpolitik and of the concentration of power, what could be tolerated for the Austrians. Although Austria, of course, is always, you know, more or less kind of West aligned when the chips are down. But nonetheless is granted, as you say, this neutral status that is simply refused in the case of the Federal Republic. But it bears keeping in mind, I guess, that the controversial character, right, of this reintegration of Germany is evident in the time it takes to actually come up with a workable solution. So a variety of other schemes are mooted and tried out, the most consequential of which is a French project to create what was called a European defense community. This has its genesis also at the very beginning of the 50s and is seen as a kind of military complement to the European coal and steel community, the genesis of the economic community, later European Union. And this project effectively would have called for the creation of fairly small German units who would have served under Allied command, that is to say, non-German command. So the idea was this was a means, it was hoped, of harnessing German power while also controlling against the threat that it might be turned against other West European states. Anyhow, this scheme is voted down, of course, by French Parliament itself in 1954. Somewhat interestingly, the coalition that does vote it down is a kind of de facto alliance between the Communist Party, which opposes German militarism as such, and the Gaullist right, which sees a threat to essentially French national sovereignty in this idea of an integrated command structure, European army. So these are concerns that obviously will return later. The result, however, it's a kind of, if you like, Pyrrhic victory for these forces, insofar as the Americans simply move immediately thereafter to bring West Germany directly into NATO, which happens in 1955, as you pointed out. It involves, among other things, in a sense, the recognition of West German sovereignty. So an end in principle to the post-war occupation regime, although, I mean, the French, British and American forces will remain on West German soil, but now, right, as allies, not as occupiers. That said, German sovereignty in this sense ought to be qualified. It remained what's been described as diluted sovereignty. Han Rieder describes it, I think, as a penetrated system in which not only does the Bonn government, in a sense, renounce a variety of kind of attributes that other states claimed, among them, right, the possession of nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons, but it's also a state and a society in which foreign intervention, notably American intervention, in collaboration with local kind of comprador elites, plays really an outsized role all throughout the Cold War period. And you might argue, in some respects, even to this day.
Yeah, another thing there's definitely at least echoes of in the present, as well as this ongoing controversy over a European alternative. You know, it seems like ancient history now, but during the Trump. It seems like ancient history now, but during the Trump administration, of course, there was a lot of talk in Europe of how can we strengthen, you know, European defense? Maybe we need strategic autonomy and so on. And so it's always worth going back through this history because you really learn that a lot of these debates that we keep having have parallels in the past and, you know, direct antecedents in many cases. And so throughout the rest of the Cold War, like I want to get into many of the questions of NATO today, but I want to kind of breeze through the history in as comprehensive a way as we can without taking too much time. So with the rest of the Cold War in the 60s and onward, what are the kind of the fates of this potential of a European alternative? I mean, is there ever really a credible answer or is it given up pretty quickly? Like it's, you know, NATO is our defense pact or nothing. And what kind of ideas emerge that might, you know, be able to provide a template for any kind of different approaches than NATO gives us today?
The great challenge to NATO, really, and in a sense the so serious challenge perhaps to date, comes from Charles de Gaulle when he returns to power in France in 1958. And it's a hotly contested subject in the scholarly literature, the question of how seriously de Gaulle really meant his challenge to the alliance and from when we should date it. He returns to power, of course, in a context in which there's a more general crisis in the alliance, stemming in the first instance from the Suez fiasco, in which, of course, the United States intervenes essentially to scotch the ambitions of its NATO allies, France and Great Britain, seeking to topple Nasser in Egypt. And this kind of opens the door to a whole litany of complaints, in particular on the part of the sort of waning European imperial powers who want to see the Atlantic Alliance, in a sense, expanded to incorporate other parts of the globe where they see themselves having strategic interests. Algeria, for example, notoriously is included, in fact, in the 1949 treaty, because at the time the Algerian département were formerly part of France. But of course, there had been hopes on the part of French elites and to an extent British elites as well of brigading alliance forces elsewhere across the globe. So de Gaulle comes to power in 58. He immediately proposes a scheme for what's called a tripartite directorate, that is to say, reconfiguring NATO to have essentially Anglo-American French command and to give it again this new global role. Now, whether de Gaulle actually thought this was feasible is not entirely clear. He himself and his supporters would later go on to claim this was simply a kind of shot across the bow of what he called the Anglo-Saxons, or he would describe as hoisting the flag of French sovereignty. In any case, the scheme is rejected, and he then engages in this sort of series of moves to distance France from the alliance, so withdrawing French naval forces in the Mediterranean from Integrated Command, insisting that the Americans withdraw nuclear forces stationed in France, and culminating famously in 1966 when he takes France out of the alliance integrated command structure, not the alliance itself, but the integrated command structure altogether, which in fact forces NATO headquarters to relocate from France to Belgium. Now, de Gaulle's alternative to the NATO system as it kind of emerges and matures in the 1960s would in practice have rested on essentially a Franco-German condominium bolstered by France's nuclear deterrent, which France has its first successful nuclear test in 1960, and then this force de frappe comes online over the subsequent decade. It's an open question, I think, to what extent this scheme was ever realistic, insofar as it would have entailed West Germany, of course, essentially preferring a French security umbrella or a French security guarantee to an American security guarantee. And I think for a lot of people, it's not clear why that would have ever appeared an attractive choice to the German leadership. At the same time, there are signs, if one looks, you know, to Adenauer's rapprochement with de Gaulle in the early 60s, that such a thing was considered. And certainly in Germany, in West Germany, I have to say, during this period, there was a form of what you could call German Gaullism that was real and did indeed seek expression. In this case, however, as in others, the Americans are extremely vigilant about squashing any sort of initiative of this kind. So in 63, there's a quite kind of impressive strong arming of Adenauer into making a series of concessions to the Americans, essentially on kind of trade and monetary issues, to ensure that the U.S. retain its troops garrisoned on West German soil. And attempts thereafter, perhaps get into it, for example, in the 1970s around Ostpolitik and Willy Brandt's détente are viewed likewise with a great deal of vigilance and suspicion in Washington.
So, yeah, like it sounds, as you said, there's always this kind of, there's rhetoric about it. There's sometimes actual concrete political pushes, but it never really seems like it takes a full, like, coherent shape of any kind of alternative that could actually garner large scale support. Because, as you said, it then raises a bunch of questions that are all kind of settled in a lot of ways in terms of who holds the balance of power. And while a lot of people might gripe that they don't like the degree of American control, if America were to not have the control, then it opens up a bunch of nasty questions within Europe. And it seems like sometimes people just decide it's easier to just let the Americans be top dog rather than have to fight amongst ourselves or have to figure out something entirely new. And I mean, we can fast forward a bit, you know, unless there's any real key moments that you want to highlight through the rest of the Cold War, because the world war obviously in now is one in which the Cold War ended, which was ostensibly NATO's reason for existing. But NATO, of course, didn't. And that kind of contradiction and the tensions that emerge from that basic dynamic really, really define a lot of both European and global politics today. Could you talk a little bit about this end of the Cold War moment and some of these really key decisions that were made? Obviously, you know, the ones that come to mind the most would be German reunification and then the whole of reunited Germany being a NATO country, and then afterwards, even farther expansion east into former Warsaw Pact, and then eventually former countries actually that were part of the Soviet Union itself. And now, you know, those decisions, especially after the 2022 invasion of Ukraine, obviously those are kind of rehashed endlessly in various op-eds and so on. So I think people might be a bit familiar with them. But again, to try to put ourselves in the actual position of, you know, what's going on in 1990 and what are the real potential decisions that can be made? What are the different political positions that different sides are pushing for? And what way could things have gone differently potentially? at that point instead of what led us to the present?
So if one sees NATO as having been created first and foremost to defend against the threat of Soviet invasion, there is something quite puzzling about its persistence after the Soviet Union, of course, peacefully dissolves itself. Something kind of enigmatic about it. And indeed, for a lot of people, as you know, you've said, in a sense, at the time, it really did seem as though NATO had, in a sense, succeeded and was now fated to disappear, as, of course, the Warsaw Pact did. But if you do adopt a different perspective, if you see NATO as having been, from its inception, really not first and foremost about defense or even containment of the USSR, but as having this role of administering and managing American domination in Europe, and there was good reason, in fact, to expect that it would persevere. So, in fact, there are schemes, right, conceived of by American policymakers going back really to the early 70s, if not earlier, that envisioned dissolution or defeat of the Soviet Union and some kind of prolongation of the NATO system in possibly a different form. So on the one hand, I think we can say right at the turn of the 1990s, there is hope, not least in Russia, but also throughout Western Europe, at any rate, in some kind of more pluralistic, perhaps egalitarian security system, in which the Americans might indeed have remained involved in European affairs, but on, as it were, equal footing with other powers, including post-Soviet Russia. Now, there's a debate, which, of course, has taken on, I suppose, kind of particular significance and polemical charge recently over when exactly the decision was made to keep NATO around, why it was made, and then, as you pointed out, this subsequent decision to expand it eastward. And I think on this subject, I mean, the work of an American political scientist named Joshua Shifrinson is really worth consulting. I would recommend his articles to your listeners. And one point he makes, and it's bolstered by access to a number of newly declassified American archives, including those of President George Herbert Walker Bush and James Baker. And what he finds is the decision not just to preserve NATO, but also to expand it, was taken not by, as is sometimes thought, so-called policy entrepreneurs or these sort of statesmen and women infatuated by liberal internationalism under the Clinton administration, but really does date back to this earlier moment under the first President Bush, and is essentially motivated by concerns of realpolitik. It's essentially motivated by the idea, which hadn't in fact changed so much over the course of the Cold War, that any rival formation to the U.S., any kind of rival system in Europe was going to be unacceptable. And that more specifically, having, as they saw it, prevailed over the Soviet Union in this great mid-century contest, it would be foolish, even inexplicable, to have kind of, to surrender those gains and simply pack one's bags and go home.
Yeah, I mean, I think your framework here for, you know, actually looking at, you know, what is the real role of NATO in your thesis about how, you know, it's as much a tool for internal management and, you know, as it is for external defense, it then makes what seems like a contradiction of NATO's persistence after the end of the Cold War. It seemed like not a contradiction at all, but rather just a symptom of the actual purpose of the alliance. And so just to go back to the first question there, I mean, that's one of the reasons I find this framework so useful, because it really helps us resolve and understand that. And from that point of view, it then actually would seem kind of ridiculous for the U.S. to even think about leaving the continent. I mean, who wins a big struggle and says, oh, well, we did great. Our prize for winning is losing all our power. You know, like in that sense, we can understand the present a lot better, I think, by taking this lens that you use.
That said, I mean, I think it probably should be stressed that the decision in particular, not just to keep NATO around, but to push eastward, was really quite controversial at the time. And I mean, this is a kind of striking contrast to subsequent rounds of enlargement, which have proceeded with very, very little kind of quibbling in the U.S. at any rate. But in the mid-90s, particular among sort of foreign policy elites, international relations professors, and what have you, there's even a kind of quasi-consensus that there's no need, in fact, to move the alliance eastward, that this promise that was made to Gorbachev when Germany was reunified ought to be respected, and that there was, you know, no interest, even in the most sort of narrowly construed terms, in needlessly provoking this newly independent, in many respects, quite unstable Russia. So it's interesting to see how that sort of fades and, in a sense, almost becomes, in certain respects, taboo, given how many mainstream figures during this period, right, in the lead up to the first wave of expansion, were expressing really forceful doubts on the subject.
And I think there's a bit of a generational difference here, too. I mean, you see some of the older guard of, you know, the real Cold War policy elite, I mean, from famously, like George Kennan, sort of the sort of architect of U.S. Cold War containment policy, Henry Kissinger, and then also like John Lewis Gaddis, who was like kind of the arch triumphalist historian of U.S. Cold War foreign policy. They're all saying at the time, if I recall correctly, you know, we shouldn't expand east, and we should sort of respect what was understood to be a promise to Gorbachev. I know there's been a lot of debates going on, you know, what was said, what wasn't said, etc. But it does seem like there were some. The idea was offered, like, don't worry, we won't sort of exploit your collapse for our gain. Like, let's all just live in peace together with the Soviets and then Russians. And then those promises were not fully heeded. But regardless of the specifics there, like you said, there was this kind of consensus of people who were in the prime of their career during the Cold War that, well, you know, Russian power is a fact of the world in their mind. And they say, OK, yes, you know, we won. That's great. But let's not push it too far. And then I think there's a new crop of people who grew up in the kind of indispensable nation era. And the idea that there would be any checks on American power whatsoever is kind of, it's like completely beyond the pale. It's completely unacceptable. And so even though both the sort of newer and older guard, to put it very bluntly, of course, but even though they both might believe in the goodness of American power, only the kind of older people that lived for a long time under the shadow of the Soviet Union and potential nuclear war can really even countenance the idea that there could be a check on U.S. power in the world. And now it seems like there's just this new kind of radicalism that just cannot. There's like, well, you know, obviously, you know, we can put NATO wherever we want. You know, who is Russia to tell us at all what to do? And they say, well, you know, why should Putin have a right to tell us, you know, where to expand? It's like, well, I mean, maybe he shouldn't, but like people have interests and there are checks on what people want to do. And just to say that there's power in the world that can check other power is not to say that power has any kind of moral weight to it, but just to describe the world as it is. And I think the Cold War generation was okay with that way of seeing the world. And there's a newer one that kind of came of age after the Clinton and Cold War era that seems completely unwilling to accept, like I said, any checks on American power.
I think it's an important point you make, and this question of a generational difference, maybe a difference in socialization, is undoubtedly there. I suppose at the same time, I would tend to qualify any too striking a kind of juxtaposition between these two periods, as say Cold War, post-Cold War American foreign policy thinking, insofar as, from my perspective, the actual extent of possible disagreement was always relatively contained. It's significant, I think, that even in the Senate debates, which were fairly heated around ratification of NATO in early 1949. In particular, there's a lot of controversy around Article 5, the kind of keystone of the alliance, right, which commits member states to defense of an alliance member when aggressed. This was seen as an infringement on Congress's prerogative to declare war and what have you, have compromises reached. But in the course of that debate, I mean, the most eloquent, really, opponent of the treaty, Robert Taft, his alternative was just simply to declare that the Monroe Doctrine now applied also to Western Europe. And I mean, in a sense, if you look at, in particular, some of the kind of realist criticism of NATO enlargement in the 1990s, very eloquent in many cases, the idea typically is not that the US should, in some sense, you know, sort of forfeit any claim to dictating European affairs or any involvement on the security side in Europe, but simply that permanently or indefinitely garrisoning American troops and what have you in Western Europe is perhaps not the best use of national resources. And, you know, for many, I suppose you make this critique, the idea is that, as indeed in the late 1940s, early 1950s, the real theater is elsewhere in the Pacific.
Yeah, I don't, of course, don't mean to imply that, like, Henry Kissinger is a warmer, fuzzier figure than, I don't know, Victoria Nuland or something. But just to say, yes, that I think there can be different views on what the best way to exercise American power is. Like, these are all shades of believing in U.S. global hegemony. They're just different ways of exercising it and what they think is most effective and what the kind of the best use of available resources are. Obviously the Cold War is filled with its own atrocities. I don't mean to say that there's a sort of a nicer attitude at that time, of course, but I just think there's a different understanding of the way in which you can wield power and not the unipolar moment does something to your brain if you're in U.S. foreign policy during that era, I think.
There's no question about it, but I suppose I'd also point to figures. I mean, someone like Zbigniew Brzezinski, right, who has this remarkable career, stretching from obviously his time in academia through to the 1990s, when he figures as this kind of eminence grise behind the decision to push NATO eastward. You know, Madeleine Albright, who'd been his pupil, I guess, right, is in some respects running the show. And I was struck in the most recent kind of survey of alliance history, which is very much worth reading by a historian named Timothy Sale. He came across this quote from 1966 when Brzezinski, who then I think was on the Policy Planning Council of the State Department, is looking at prospects for détente and so forth, argues that these should be pursued, you know, with great moderation, and furthermore that NATO, whatever the case, ought to be seen as a vehicle for collaboration, in his words, between the U.S. and other nations in Europe, you know, even beyond what he's already kind of seen as a perspective into the Cold War. So that would be a figure. And, you know, of course, there are many others who, you know, kind of represents a kind of continuity across these different periods.
Yeah, I see him as kind of the first articulation of what the kind of unipolar ethos would be in American foreign policy. He presages that, like, really, really effectively, I think, and is now sort of better suited to our current time, at least as a representation of American foreign policy than he really necessarily was in the Carter administration, I think. But more to this, like I said, the expansion, should NATO, should NATO expand east question, it can go on and on, and gets very, very in depth, and back and forth. But keeping that in mind, of course, because nothing you can understand in Ukraine happens as it does without that question. But I think it's not only that there's a kind of resentment in the rest of the world just to NATO expanding east, but also it's more expansive role, the out of area or out of business thesis, where they've, you know, defeated the main adversary to the east, and now, you know, what else are we going to do? Let's find some new playgrounds, and that, from the perspective of the alliance, I think it's kind of any institution wants a kind of internal logic to perpetuate itself. It makes sense for them. The rest of the world sees what looks like just unilateral decisions to go in and bomb various countries for, you know, whatever justification they come up with. And really, I think a lot of the rest of the world can see that and look pretty terrified here. Of course, you know, thinking cases like Kosovo, Libya, et cetera. Could you talk a bit about that decision and the basic out of area, out of business thesis, kind of leading up maybe to, I guess, like Libya 2011, because then all of a sudden Eastern Europe comes back to the fore pretty quickly. But there's this kind of 20-year period where it seems like NATO is now focused on other issues beyond its traditional kind of, you know, defending the full the gap remit of what it used to be.
This, I think, has to be seen very much in connection with what we discussed earlier in terms of U.S. attempts to preempt any kind of rival security architecture from emerging in Europe. Because initially, on the American side, at least, I mean, there's some degree of hesitancy about getting involved in the Balkans wars of the 1990s. And, you know, one ought to be kind of prudent in assessing the motivations behind eventual involvement, eventual military intervention. But one of them undoubtedly was the desire to forestall what at the time, you know, as usual, was a solution favored by the French, which was some kind of autonomous or semi-autonomous European response force that would have addressed this issue on its own. And so that prompts intervention right in Bosnia in 1995, the Kosovo War in 1999. This consideration of ensuring that the U.S. still has, I mean, in the words of an official at the time, a seat at the table in all sorts of other domains in European politics is a major one. And it should also be said, a consideration that considerably outweighs any specifically military utility that NATO has in these conflicts, or indeed the conflicts of the 21st century, right, in Afghanistan, to a certain extent in Iraq, where the Americans are routinely frustrated by having to deal with, you know, these more complex kind of chains of command, having to put up with, you know, reluctance on the part of European allies to get their hands dirty. Germany, notoriously in Afghanistan, you know, expresses all sorts of concerns about rules of engagement and so on, thinking that the Americans are perhaps a bit trigger happy and what have you. But those purely kind of operational considerations, again, are outweighed by the larger political logic that entails ensuring that the U.S. is present and that no rival or alternative surfaces in these sort of military security crises.
And now with the current Ukraine war, of course, you know, as many people point out, didn't start in 2022, but, you know, the Russian encroachments far earlier than that. Without talking too much about just the outbreak of that war itself, because I think it's its own kind of topic here, I'd like to talk about what that actually has done to the NATO alliance, because you went from this period where, like I said, you know, the NATO is trying to go out of area to justify itself. All of these wars end pretty catastrophically. You know, actually the first time that Article 5, the collective defense aspect of NATO is actually activated is after the U.S. is attacked on September 11th, then spends 20 years in Afghanistan for nothing. Libya bombing 2011, total disaster. So the kind of counterterrorism mission, the out of area vibe generally, it doesn't seem to be working anymore. And you have then this real kind of crisis in the late 2010s, right? You know, Trump saying it's obsolete. Macron had this, you know, his brain dead comment. And then all of a sudden, you know, seemingly out of nowhere, just as the alliance is experiencing these various crises, I guess on one hand, you know, you have Biden become elected in the U.S., who's a big, you know, a real old school Atlanticist. And then you also have really one of the best things that could have happened for the alliance is Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. And this then re-justifies everything that NATO wants people to think it stands for. That it's an alliance of democracies. Here's this bad autocracy, you know, invading another democracy. And there, Ukraine is not in NATO. They got attacked. Well, look at all the NATO countries. None of them got attacked. Therefore, if you're in NATO, you experience peace. Therefore, as their logic goes, to have peace, we must have more NATO. And a lot of people pretty much buy into that, where you see a lot of internal dissent of NATO die down in countries that are already in it. And you have a big push of other countries to join. Notably, Finland and Sweden, who had both really kind of staked a lot of their identity for a while on their neutral position. You have a lot of European countries also try to show allegiance to the U.S. in different ways. And I think often the best way to show that they kind of respect and want to value the transatlantic alliance is by cutting a big check for a fancy piece of American military hardware. In this case, the F-35 and its staggering price tag and sort of dubious operational record. But it's a way of saying, hey, Americans, like, we want to be your friend for a long time. We're going to buy your extremely expensive jet. And so there's this whole big rush back into the U.S. camp. And then all of a sudden, seemingly out of nowhere, NATO is now completely beyond critique. But of course, the underlying, you know, challenges are still there. And we'll get to this in the conclusion in terms of, you know, potential kind of future outcomes here with the instability in the U.S., et cetera. But can you talk a little bit about this moment of the post-2022 rush to re-embrace NATO and the kind of the contradictions contained within that?
I think perhaps the first thing to say, to rewind for a second, is that, I mean, NATO's history with Ukraine goes back quite a while. I mean, longer perhaps than many think, and is of interest in its own right and essential, really, to understanding the present situation. I think last year, in the pages of the Times Literary Supplement, historian Stephen Kotkin said, sort of en passant, that Ukraine may not be in NATO, but NATO is in Ukraine. I mean, pithily put. And indeed, I mean, this goes back really to the immediate kind of post-independence period in the country, right? Ukraine, I believe, is the first of the Commonwealth of Independent States, the post-Soviet CIS, to join Partnership for Peace, right? This kind of antechamber, in a way, for NATO membership set up after the end of the Cold War. Ukrainians participate in, I believe, every U.S. post-Cold War military intervention abroad. I mean, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. By 97, I mean, Ukraine is, you know, launched this now recurrent series of naval exercises, the Sea Breeze exercises in the Black Sea, to great alarm on the part of Russian commanders at Sevastopol. And that same year sees the opening of a NATO information center, propaganda center in Kiev, a signature of this joint partnership agreement between Ukraine and NATO, and NATO access to this important training facility on the Polish border outside of Lviv. The Yavoriv training facility. Now, I mean, the kind of history goes on from there. In 2002, Ukraine, of course, kind of resolves to apply for membership, setting it in some respects on the path it's continued on to this day. But there's a contrast here, and this is illustrated quite powerfully, I think, by the sociologist Volodymyr Shenko in a piece he contributed to the volume we put together for Verso, which looks at the evolution, in fact, of Ukrainian public opinion over time. And there it's clear that, you know, until very recently, indeed, there was never a kind of stable constituency in Ukraine in favor of abandoning its post-independence neutral status and aligning with NATO. In fact, there are moments in the course of the history to which I just alluded of real kind of furor in the country, notably around the Kosovo War in 99, which I think is actually condemned by Ukrainian parliament. I mean, there's, you know, it's extremely unpopular, the population as a whole. Nonetheless, alignment of at least a powerful fraction of elites ensures that this kind of, Ukrainian Westbindung is not rerouted. So that's just, I guess, a little bit of background, which obviously continues and fits and starts up through the 2014 crisis and provides some kind of important context. But to answer the question you just posed very rightly concerning the sort of rebound of the alliance from what looked to be low waters at the end of the last decade, it's a kind of cliche of NATO itself and of, I guess, orthodox or official scholarship on the alliance to say that its history is sort of one of continual crisis from which it inevitably emerges strengthened. And I think, you know, like many cliches, it's not entirely false and has perhaps a corollary, which is to say that whenever the alliance or, in fact, the U.S. position in Europe appears particularly precarious, a reheating of tensions with Russia, or with the Soviet Union, now Russia, has historically often arrived as a kind of divine surprise to reinforce the U.S. hand, right, in the continent. So you're exactly right. I mean, as recently, I suppose it's in 2019, the French President Emmanuel Macron gives this interview, proclaims NATO brain dead at the time. I mean, he's furious over this contretemps in Syria, whereby essentially Turkey, having tried and failed to get NATO to intervene directly in the civil war in 2012, has launched this really brutal offensive against the Kurds, which are at the time the U.S. in a sense kind of NATO's allies in persecuting a campaign against ISIS. So there's an atmosphere of real dysfunction, compounded in a sense by concerns in the Western European states over all sorts of U.S. practices that are deemed unacceptable. And, tapping Angela Merkel's phone to begin with, the revelations of domestic spy in the U.S., as well as, this kind of vast global network of signals intelligence, after effects of these disastrous wars in the Middle East, all compound together, if you like, with the kind of rambunctious figure of President Trump to produce an image of the U.S. and U.S. power in Europe as in crisis. Now, it's inarguably true that the outbreak of war between Russia and Ukraine has essentially reversed this state of affairs. And in fact, there were early editorials on the subject. One, I seem to remember, in the New York Times, essentially saying that, from the Waterloo of this withdrawal from Afghanistan, very ill viewed, of course, in European capitals. I mean, European press, you had these, kind of crocodile tears all over the place about the fact they were barely even, the U.S. having brigaded them into this, unending, it seemed, for a long time war, then just sort of gets out of there, not even doing them the courtesy of consultation. So after this, low watermark, all of us, all had been forgotten, all had been forgiven when Russian armor, crossed into Ukraine. So there's substance to this idea, and clearly the remilitarization of Europe that we've seen over the past year and a half has as an effect, a strengthening of NATO and a strengthening of the U.S. and, its continental position for all sorts of reasons, not least given dependence in many cases on the Americans for military procurement, for hardware, and what have you. I suppose we'll see how long this lasts. I mean, there are clearly some signs of fracture, disagreement. I mean, I guess just last month, in the Slovakian elections, you had, I believe, did an episode on this subject, but,
Robert Fico, about the election of Fico,
returned to office, right, on, I guess, kind of a peace platform. I mean, calling for an end both to weapons shipments to Ukraine and sanctions against Russia, opposed, I believe, to Ukraine joining NATO and so forth. I mean, Viktor Orban's Hungary has kind of made similar moves. And Turkey, of course, a non-EU NATO state, has also kind of attempted a semi-independent role. That said, I mean, it's also possible to overstate the significance of these sort of centers of dissent. And I think, an illustrative example can be found in the sort of Western European far right. I mean, if you take a case of someone like Meloni in Italy or Le Pen's daughter in France, I mean, you can see these parties, which in some respects are sort of putatively nationalistic, chauvinistic, and what have you, who really don't miss a beat in proclaiming their fealty to the Atlantic Alliance. So, and I think, conversely, looking at the left, the extent to which these Atlanticist bona fides are policed. Everyone can think of in the UK, obviously, now, apparently, you know, a loyalty oath to NATO is practically a requirement of being a member of Keir Starmer's Labour Party. The handling of Jean-Luc Mélenchon in France, right? Criticisms of Mélenchon by green socialists, what have you, routinely insist on his supposed kind of heresies in foreign policy. In Germany, I mean, within Die Linke, now that Sachsen-Anhalt is broken off to launch her own formation, these sort of considerations are also not in any sense irrelevant. So I think looking at least at the West European domestic landscape, I would think that NATO commanders have reason for some degree of confidence and optimism.
Yeah, I think that does seem to be the case. I mean, at least in terms of the existence and continued existence of their alliance, certainly it doesn't seem like there's a real serious internal threat. However, in terms of any kind of outward stability, that does not seem like that's on the cards. But as you probably rightly point out, that's not always the main goal. Being aware of your time, of course, we can try to wrap up soon. But one thing that I find interesting, and I think it really is important to consider in terms of the future of the alliance, is this role of military equipment and sales and the kind of actual logistical, like infrastructural side of this. And at the same time that NATO has this massive PR boost as Russian armor crosses the border, so does the PR strategies and the sort of branding of defense companies, which used to be kind of like a dirty thing. People would say, oh, I don't want to invest in like arms makers. That's kind of gross. And now I recently saw, I think it was a Bloomberg article about this. It was an investor saying that ESG investing, which used to mean environmental, social and good governance, like stocks, now the S no longer means sustainability. Now it means security. And so all these defense companies are like, yeah, we're the defenders of freedom. Like, don't you love democracy? Invest in Rheinmetall or Lockheed Martin. To be a bit glib there, but it is revealing. But then there's also the actual real like nuts and bolts issue of this, which is, like I said, Europe now deciding, okay, we need to invest a lot more in defense. Oftentimes that comes from the U.S., and especially, of course, this F-35, which you talk about in your introduction in this NATO-politanism book, which is, of course, phenomenal and we'll link to and everyone should buy. But you talk about from a Forbes article, the F-35ification of Europe. And there's effectively, they call a lock-in factor guaranteed by the corresponding ground support, spare parts and maintenance. Europe, in short, is now committed to American-made gear for decades to come. And I think that poses a really interesting potential contradiction for the years and decades ahead, which is, you look at the polling now, Donald Trump doing quite well in a number of crucial states in the U.S. Of course, he was very against a lot of elements of the Atlantic Alliance and NATO. However, Europe is now more tightly bound. Europe is more tightly bound to the U.S. now, almost in some cases, than it ever has been, even while the actual political foundations in the most powerful state are perhaps fraying more than they ever have. And I just see that reaching it's not even a breaking point. It's like because it won't break, but it's like this zombie Atlanticism that's carried on by some of the institutions, some of the infrastructural links, the military hardware. But the actual high level political willingness to have that, I mean, in Washington might not be there anymore. And it seems like a very dangerous moment, especially as you have this emergence of what you sort of termed as far right pro NATO sentiment in some European countries. So like, could we just close out by, I guess, speculating or discussing some of these issues, both that I raise, and I'm sure you have a bunch of others on your mind as far as how the alliance could evolve or dissolve or devolve, whatever you want to, however you want to describe it.
Yeah, zombie Atlanticism is a good phrase, although in a way I wonder if it's not a sort of hostage to fortune. I mean, in some quarters at least, Atlanticism seems alive and well and perhaps more robust than ever. I mean, if one considers, the German Green Party, for example, and other formations in Europe. Your point, just to touch on the things you said a minute ago. The point about military hardware is obviously important. And I mean, one's come across statements over the past year and a bit that are remarkably frank. I mean, you cite this Forbes article, you have, you know, defense contractors, think tanks, I mean, even public officials, you know, essentially saying in a totally frank way that U.S. support for Ukraine is, you know, great bang for the buck, that, you know, not only is this creating jobs back in the States, but also degrading Russia and not, you know, not to forget, of course, defending the cause of Ukrainian freedom and what have you. I mean, this can take, of course, quite gristly form, you know, the expression. I think it's Oliver North of all people, kind of at the end of last year, who made some comment to the effect, this is, you know, their blood, our bullets. And in that respect, you know, a very handsome kind of wager from the perspective of
I think the Republicans released an ad that was like, look how many Russians we've killed with none of our own guys. Like, this is a bargain. Biden, like you said, released a thing. It was like, do you know how many jobs we've made in America by equipping Ukraine? It's like, ooh, they're really just saying it, aren't they?
No, it's ghastly. It's, you know, it's of course completely bipartisan. I mean, I know it's, you know, Dick Blumenthal made very similar comments, I guess, you know, a month or so ago. But yeah, it is striking to see these kind of sentiments articulated in so unabashed a way. What you point out concerning the lock-in effect of these complex weapon systems, F-35s, right, Abrams tanks, and so forth, is extremely significant. Because at the end of the day, I mean, if you take into account maintenance, the kind of software updates, the, you know, everything required by these systems, you could really see them not so much as, you know, weapons of war in a straightforward sense, but as these kind of embodiments, in a way, very expensive embodiments or expressions of an enduring commitment to the U.S. or a mortgaging of one's own security on the part of European powers to America, right? And
it's like a subscription service, right? You don't have a music library anymore, right? You have to pay Spotify every month, and it's like you can't actually have your own military hardware if you're Europe. You have to pay this consistent subscription fee to America to keep the F-35 going.
That's exactly right. Yeah, not even to, you know, speak of the sort of technical merits and fortunes of the F-35 project, has of course been a colossal boondoggle. On the subject, you know, the potential re-election of President Trump next year, what consequences that might have for the alliance? It's of course very hard to say. He did indeed express, you know, some kind of critical views about NATO, including some actually very eccentric views. I mean, you know, sort of veering between the idea that the alliance, you know, was no longer worth maintaining, the Europeans were simply kind of freeloading and what have you, to the notion that it ought to be expanded to Saudi Arabia, an idea that he ventilated at some point. You know, I think here probably the thing that's worth stressing is that if NATO can be seen in some sense as a way of restricting democracy in Europe, or at any rate, you know, locking in also these European polities to a security arrangement in which these existential decisions, the most existential decisions over peace and war, life and death, are in some meaningful sense, you know, contracted to Washington. It also served historically and to a degree still today as a means of binding America to Europe. So it's not to be forgotten that at the end of the Second World War, I mean, the majority of public opinion in the States is indifferent to foreign policy, basically, and if not indifferent, you know, what is described pejoratively as isolationist. And so in some respect, you can see both NATO institutionally and this corresponding attempt, again, talking about the late 40s, I guess there's an Arthur Vandenberg quote, where he says, you know, basically, we're going to need to scare the hell out of them. That is, they scare the hell out of our own population by brandishing, you know, the threat of communist hordes to convince them to kind of make the kind of sacrifices necessary to ensure that the U.S. Retains its privileged role in Europe. In that sense, I mean, I suppose there are a lot of reasons to think that in the U.S. as well, there are factors militating in favor of continuing this Atlantic relationship in zombified form or not. And after all, Trump, in office, signally failed to, withdraw America from the alliance, or in fact, do much of anything else. So I don't know that there's necessarily reason to think that a second term would mean anything different. But of course, it's very difficult to say at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's both. We're both well aware it's a fool's game to try to predict anything that would Donald Trump would or would not do. So I don't want to put anything on the record of saying, he definitely will or won't do this. But yeah, regardless, certainly not what the Atlanticist community is hoping for. And like you say, when you sort of pointed out that its enthusiasm for the alliance is very much not zombified in a lot of European capitals, it raises a very weird potential situation in which enthusiasm for the empire is stronger in the periphery than the metropole. Whereas like the German Greens cheerleading for NATO while Washington has like a little more recalcitrance than it did. And it's just like, America come back kind of thing rather than Ami go home. It could be a strange inversion of some trends we've seen, but as you rightly point out, also a degree of continuity with, these three different roles that NATO plays in terms of, both kind of keeping Europe submissive, but also keeping America there.
That's a very interesting observation. I think, nobody who's kept an eye on the European press and the American press over the past period kind of failed to ignore that, a great deal more sort of diverse spectrum of opinions is permissible in the States, in fact, than in much of Europe, concerning, for example, this proxy war being waged in Ukraine or any number of other topics involving U.S. foreign policy. That's true at any rate of, let's say, the kind of ideological state apparatus, as much of like bourgeois opinion and kind of political elites. Whether it's true of the population's concern in every case is a slightly different question. But there's no doubt, too, also ought to be stressed perhaps, that NATO expends a great deal of energy in promoting itself, right? Information warfare, if you like, it's been part of alliance activities from the beginning and shows no sign of waning, I don't think, through now these various centers that have been established in Eastern Europe. There's an excellent report on this subject by the American historian Joshua Rotz, who's based in Berlin, looking at these various centers involved in, so cybersecurity, so-called, or counter disinformation and what have you, that also in some sense serve basically to propagandize for the alliance and for the U.S.
Yeah, we'll link to this as well. But Thomas Meany, who's a co-author or contributed a chapter in the book, also has a great piece in The Guardian that talks a lot about the PR campaigns that NATO has done for itself, up until the present, but also including, really, really early on. There's a hilarious picture of like the NATO bus driving around Greece being like, hey, everybody like NATO. It's like little kids running up to it, all in Greek letters, NATO. So we'll link to that as well, because, yeah, it's a of course, back to the original point. An alliance that's just for, hey, we're just trying to keep everybody safe, there's no internal management going on at all, maybe wouldn't need such a strong kind of PR campaign throughout its history in order to keep everyone on board and keep everybody in line.
That's quite right. It's not only a PR campaign, of course, but also takes the form of quite concrete sort of interpersonal exchanges, maybe most significant, in fact, on the military side, right? Where, in fact, as far as I know, at any rate, in the militaries of the NATO member states, the alliance is quite popular indeed, because it means these sort of prestigious junkets, career advance, access to this cutting edge materiel and what have you. So that I think has played an important role in shoring up support within these countries for the alliance, as have a whole series of kind of penumbra of governmental and semi-governmental civilian type exchanges. The Young Leaders Program in France, German Marshall Fund, Atlantic Council. There's a galaxy of these things, which,
I always get emails for this in my PhD program, because like the title of it is, International Relations. And so even though I don't do very NATO friendly work. Still, they sort of assume like, oh, we'll send this to their like their email list because like, yeah, join this NATO young thing. This submit an abstract to this NATO conference to the NATO. Like it's always you can see how they kind of foster these cadres and like create this ongoing support. Not that people wouldn't have believed it already, but it's very kind of present in there. And you see that there are real tangible material benefits for a given career just to sort of hitch your wagon to the sort of NATO project, which is, you know, present in so many European countries, obviously, like really paralleling, paralleling the alliance as well. But yeah, there's these like NATO youth groups too that are in non-NATO countries as well. I was looking at this recently. There's both a like young the youth group for NATO. There's one in both Armenia and Azerbaijan, both being like, let's join NATO. And I was like, that's kind of a sick joke. Both like listed right next to each other on the webpage.
I didn't realize that. And certainly in Ukraine, there's been one, I think, you know, since the beginning of the 2000s, which, you know, up until, of course, the outbreak of war, he was organizing hackathons and whatever that is. I've never participated in a hackathon, but, you know, doing all sorts of things, I guess, to gin up support.
Yeah, so there's the ideological apparatus as well. I mean, I feel like we could do a whole other episode on that sometime because that's a fascinating topic. But
Gramsci, right, says that I think between consent and coercion lies corruption, and I mean I think probably it would be unwise to overemphasize that dynamic, right? The extent to which various kind of European elites are just sort of bought and sold, but you know. There are all sorts of forms of influence, you know, some more obvious than others. And I think it would probably be difficult to understand the political landscape in Europe today, not least on the left or center left, without taking into account some of those aspects.
Well, we'll have you back on another time and then we can really cook up the plans to attack NATO ideological hegemony. Yeah, we'll so stay tuned, Sprachbremse listeners, for that.
Well, don't answer these emails. I mean, by then you might have been converted. You might have been, you know,
I'm gonna be cashing my NATO checks by then. No. Well, great. Thanks so much for coming on. This is a really fascinating conversation. And like I said, I mean, I feel like we could keep chatting on this endlessly. And just to close out, and let you go right after this, I promise, one more question. But a way to kind of lead us into the future is there's a lot of anxiety about, you know, the future of democracy, both in the US and Europe. And as we talked about earlier in the episode, NATO is often seen as both a tool to protect democracy internally and advance it externally, often explicitly as a, quote, alliance of democracies. And you actually say this close to the start of your piece. Insofar as NATO has a claim to be an alliance of democracies, this is best understood in restrictive terms. By design, not flaw, it has effectively limited the exercise of sovereignty on the part of its constituent publics, insulating existential decisions over war and peace from the hurly-burly of electoral politics. I think that's true in a lot of ways, but there's also some issues of, you know, ongoing like military coups throughout history or the balance between civilian and military control. So how does NATO relate to democracy and how might it in the future as a way to kind of lead us into the future with some thoughts there?
We've just seen, I think, an illustration of this in a sense in Sweden, right? Where there was an idea at one point of having a national referendum on abandonment of neutrality and joining NATO. And this was dispensed with the pretext being, you know, it would open the door to foreign interference and disinformation, right? But there are precedents of other sorts. In the Czech Republic, when membership was on the agenda in the late 90s, a referendum likewise was considered and then ultimately dropped on consultation with NATO leaders and with the Americans because Czech public opinion was thought to be insufficiently informed to make this type of decision for itself. But you're exactly right to point to the question of civilian control, which is another kind of long-running commitment of the alliance, part of how it conceives of itself, and one of the great kind of blessings it's meant to have brought to new member states. This really is rather ironic, you know, from a historical perspective. If you just simply look at the track record, at the heart of the alliance itself in 1958, de Gaulle, of course, is returned to power by a military coup in Algiers. He then has to face off another coup only 3 years later, also in Algiers, in that case, led by a number of generals who had command experience with NATO, which de Gaulle viewed, of course, quite grimly. 1960, you have a coup in Turkey, rather spectacularly, in which, if I'm not mistaken, the prime minister and two other cabinet ministers are executed by hanging. I mean, 20 years later, another Turkish coup, which is in fact led by an officer who had been, I believe, commander of a NATO-backed anti-communist stay-behind forces, they're sometimes called. Greek democracy, 1967, right, strangled in the cradle, in a sense, by the colonel's coup, brings to power dictatorship, fell by another coup only sort of 5 or 6 years later. And there are a series of examples of this type in which, you know, not only can we see that NATO as such is not a particularly strong guarantor of either civilian control or political stability, really, at least in a certain sense, within its constituent states, but can actually serve to kind of aggravate certain types of conflict. I mean, another illustrative example, perhaps a kind of rule-proving exception, would be the Carnation Revolution in Portugal, where, of course, this time you have a left-wing kind of military insurgency, which topples the Salazarist regime itself, it ought to be said, right, a founding member of NATO, which, you know, says, I think, a great deal about, you know, the sense in which this was ever really an alliance of democracies. Following the revolution, the Americans are extremely concerned that government of the left with communist participation might come to power. And in fact, contingency plans are drawn up not only to eject Portugal from NATO, for which there is no legal provision. I mean, there's no there's a provision for countries voluntarily leaving the alliance, but none for them being kicked out. But to expel Portugal from NATO and unilaterally seize the Azores islands. This doesn't come about. Ultimately, the socialist prime minister Soares, you know, pledges his loyalty to NATO and so forth. But one I think can see from this you know, kind of set of examples the degree to which both of these, you know, cornerstone values, as it were, that the alliance purports to defend, to enshrine, have been, you know, observed unevenly, shall we say, over time.
I think that's a good way, a good note, because to leave it on, because obviously not a reassuring one, but the extent that sometimes people want to view NATO, right, as this bulwark against authoritarianism or illiberalism. But you're right by pointing to the history there that often very illiberal, even like military coups, so on, can be welcome within the alliance. So,
yeah, I mean, even, I mean, more recently, of course, in a somewhat like, you know, ghoulish example, the 2016 coup attempt against Erdogan sees, I think, you know, the vast majority of Turkish military representatives on NATO command. You know, they kind of like, they're there one day and they're not there the next. You know, there's a sort of purge that ensues. But yeah, I think precisely that element, let's say, of kind of illiberalism and so forth, doesn't seem to have disappeared. And, you know, indeed, may only, as I think you kind of indicated earlier, be expected to grow stronger.
So it... NATO may be defending against something, but it's not anti-democratic forces necessarily, I think it's safe to say. Well, yeah, great. Thanks so much. That was a really fascinating conversation, and I appreciate you taking so much of your time to chat with me.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll catch you next time. Tschüss.